were before. Welcome to Eye to the Sky, the UFO synopsis, here on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network, also broadcast live on UPRN 105.3 in New Orleans. I'm your host, Dee Andrew, and tonight my guest is Kyle Lovern. But before we get started, I've got a couple of announcements to make. The first one, I think, is just absolutely wonderful. Angela Joyner, everyone knows her with her connection to the Stephenville, Texas sightings, is getting her own program here on UPRN. It's going to be called The Joyner Report. It will air Fridays from 10 p.m. to 12 a.m. Central Time, starting May 15th. So join us here to listen to Angela and learn about her journey into the sometimes strange but wonderful world of ufology. I think she's going to be a great addition to the network. Looking forward to it. Also, I need to remind everyone that you can also listen to the UFO Paranormal Radio Network on your cell phone by calling 704-631-4060 and entering the four-digit station ID code 2899. And my guest tonight, Kyle Lovern, is a longtime journalist in the southern West Virginia. Too many directions there. Working in both newspaper and radio as an award-winning writer and reporter, his work has been published in a variety of forms and publications. His expertise is as a news reporter, yet he has also covered county and state sporting events and for many years served as a popular newspaper columnist in southern West Virginia and eastern Kentucky. His featured articles and photographs have been published in Golden Seal Magazine, Wild, Wonderful West Virginia Magazine, and other distinguished publications. He was born and reared in rural Mingo County, West Virginia, in the small community of Nolan. And he's authored the book Appalachian Case Study, UFO Sightings, Alien Encounters, and the Unexplained Phenomenon. And I've read this book, and it's a really nice little, easy book to read, easy book to carry. And I love it, and I would like everybody here to help me welcome Kyle to our program this evening.
Well, thank you, Dee. I'm glad to be here, and love the invitation to be on your show.
Oh, well, I like to get people that are doing good research on the UFO subject, let people know that they're out there and help them get familiar with each individual's body of work, and I think this one's pretty good.
Well, thanks, and I'll be glad. It's going to be good to let people know out in Arizona and Louisiana and wherever they may be listening to about this book, and let them know a little bit about Appalachia, some of the cases we've had over the years here. West Virginia's had a lot of historic cases, and as I mentioned to you, I'm working on another book and. Still getting a lot of calls with more stories. So it's amazing how many people have seen UFOs or had some kind of experience, or they know someone that has had experiences.
Well, first off, what got you started on the subject of UFOs?
Well, let's go way back. I was about 8 or 9 years old, and as you mentioned there, I was from a little rural town called Nolan, and the thing to do in the summer was to sit on our front porch. We had a front porch wing and a couple chairs, and that's what I was doing with my family one summer evening, and we collectively saw 3 objects coming from Kentucky. We live right on the border, so you could look over across from where I lived and you would see Kentucky. We were on the West Virginia side. That's how close it was. But we saw 3 glowing objects in a triangular form come right over top of the mountain, not maybe 100 yards from where we lived. They just hovered there on top of the mountain. It was amazing.
Kyle,
to me. Yeah.
Kyle, I'm being asked by my producer to ask you to speak up just a bit. You're a little low.
Okay. And we saw those objects hovering right over top of the mountain, you know, and it was just, it fascinated me. And I think that sort of tweaked my interest, and from that point, I've always been interested in and tried to find books on the subject. Of course, now you can find so many more, but in the 60s and 70s, you didn't find as many. But any time that I could find something to read about it, or saw something on TV about it, or saw something in the newspaper, heard, you know, on television, I was, you know, just continued to be interested in the subject. And over the years, it was still there. You know, I didn't talk a lot about it to some people because you know how people are with the stereotype, but it was always there for me. And I collected a few stories, and then and when I was in high school, I had another sighting, and that was during the big wave of UFO flap in the fall of 1973, when people were seeing UFOs all over the East Coast and in several states, and I had another sighting. So again, it's just something I've always been interested in, and I finally decided to write this book, and I'm just pleased that I found a publisher that was willing to publish it for me, and in fact, like I said, he's going to publish a sequel too.
I thought it was a great little book. It's not one of these big, huge, thick, oh gosh, those 700-800 page book that you go, oh man, am I ever going to get through this?
Right.
It's a nice, easy sized book to handle. It's not one that if you fall asleep while reading, it's not going to come in and smack you in the face and break your nose. But I loved it. The stories in it are awesome. When did you first start researching the material that's in this book?
Let's see. I would say in the early 90s, there was one magazine that I'd written a couple of stories for, and I had those stories, and then decided to try to collect a few more, so I put the word out. Being the newspaper columnist, I was able to put a couple of blurbs in my column that, hey, if anybody's had an unusual sighting or story, I'd be interested in listening to it, and you know, it's something I'm interested in, and that helped, because I was contacted by some folks, and made a couple of radio appearances on local radio stations and talked about it and got contacts and just collected these stories, and finally I put them together, and as you say, they're first-hand reports. These are your everyday average people that are credible as far as I'm concerned, and that had UFO sightings or interesting experiences, and all of these in this book are from Appalachia. In my new book, which we'll talk about later, I'm expanding and getting into Kentucky, which, as I said, we border Kentucky where I live, and then even getting into Virginia and a little bit into Pennsylvania, because, of course, the Appalachian region actually goes from New York State all the way down to Alabama and Georgia, so all the states in between. So it's a lot of territory to cover, but some good stories.
I enjoyed reading them. In the introduction, you tell of how West Virginia had inspired people like Gary Barker and John Keel, Bud Hopkins, Stan
exactly.
Friedman, and Frank Drake. What are some of the cases that was the inspiration for some of these men?
Well, a lot of people, I guess, across the nation has heard of the Mothman. That happened in the mid-60s in Point Pleasant in Mason County, West Virginia, where some teenagers that were driving around cruising saw this huge winged creature with big red eyes, and then several other people in that area continued to see this. It made national news, and as you mentioned, Gray Barker, one of the early ufologists and authors of this phenomenon, wrote about that, and John Keel, and that's one story that is really famous that occurred in West Virginia. In fact, they made a movie about it a few years ago. Richard Gere stars in it. You might have saw it, The Mothman Prophecies.
Mm-hmm.
Another really interesting case happened, I think it was in 1952, if my memory serves me right. I don't have my notes in front of me, but it happened in Flatwoods, West Virginia, and that's in Braxton County. And there's a good book out there about it. That's why I didn't write a lot about it, because there's been a couple books written about it. But this incident occurred, and now it looks like that what these people saw were some young kids that were playing football in a schoolyard, and their mother, they thought at first they saw like a meteor that came through the sky. It was in the late evening, about this time of day here in Eastern time, and they saw it land up on a nearby mountain or hill above their farm, and they went up to investigate, and what they saw was this little hovering craft, and it was spewing out some kind of metallic liquid, kind of sulfuric thing. They said it had a smell, and the thing about it that made, you know, and they always say there's no evidence for these cases, but these people, they got sick, they threw up, they were nauseated after that, and then the next day the military came in, quarantined off the area, and went up and apparently gathered some soil samples and some branches from where this thing had hovered, and that was witnessed by several people. In fact, I met one of the original eyewitnesses last summer, who's still alive. And, again, another good case. And then, of course, it was covered up, as like in most cases, like everyone knows about the Roswell case and others, but there's been so many others that have been covered up, and you never heard anything else about it. But over the years, I think the fact that we are a real rural area, a real mountainous area, there's been a lot of sightings in Appalachia, and it just continues to today, really.
That makes a lot of sense. There's a lot of sightings, in the Southwest.
Exactly.
That were, the population is very sparse.
Exactly.
And you don't have a lot of city lights blocking out the sky.
Exactly. The desert areas of the Southwest, or even in the Texas area where they've had some lately, Stephenville area, as you mentioned earlier. Yeah, there's not as much of a populated area. And if these UFOs, wherever they come from, probably another planet, if they didn't want to be detected, they would come to an area like that. And if they were coming down to get soil samples, or, maybe abduct someone where they wouldn't be as noticed, then they would come to an area like this.
On an average, of all the people that you've interviewed, before they spoke with you, had they reported their sightings or encounters with, like, say, MUFON or Air Force, for the cases
exactly
further back in history, or any other reporting?
That's a very good question. No, probably almost 100% have not. I think a lot of it is people, because of the stereotype, especially in the 60s and 70s, maybe even to the 80s, I think things are changing now, they were sort of hesitant about reporting something like this because of what people would say. Even now, people will make fun of you. A lot of people will talk to me when I go out now that they know that I got the book out, and they want to share a story with me, but sometimes you'll still get a little jab knowing somebody that they want to tease you about it. So I think people are afraid to talk about it. And then a lot of people don't know about MUFON or the National UFO Reporting Center, some of the agencies we have out there now that where you can report a sighting or an experience. And so they haven't. And that's why I'm real pleased that most of these people felt comfortable enough with me after they talked to me. They saw that I was sincere and dedicated, and they shared their story with me. And that's continued to now, today, as I work on another book and hopefully even another one after this.
Okay, now this leads up to my next question. How did you find about these people and their stories?
It was just sort of lucky on some cases. And again, I think, the word gets around, and just doing some research. And again, where I've been in the media, in newspaper and radio, maybe hearing about something, and just tracing people down. Or, again, I put some contact information out there in the newspaper in one of my columns, and got a couple of calls, a couple of stories from that. And actually, now that this book has come out and it's got my contact information in through the publisher, I've been getting a lot of other contacts. As far away as, for instance, a guy from California called me who used to live in Virginia, and he had a really good story talking about him and his father and a couple other guys were out hunting, camping and hunting, and they had a real good sighting experience in the mid-60s. So this has opened up a lot of doors for me with the first book being published, and I'm getting more contacts from people after they've bought the book and read it, and they wanted to share their story.
There's quite a few stories in your book.
Right.
That occurred in Mingo County.
Yeah.
What's your favorite one?
Let's see. I've got the book in front of me. Let me glance through it. You know, my favorite story, though, in this book, I think, is the first chapter after the introduction is about the Wayne County man. Do you remember that one?
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I got the book in front of me, too.
Yeah. I mean, this guy, a very credible witness. I got to know him. He was a Vietnam veteran, you know, just a hard-working guy, worked for the U.S. Postal Service. He had a couple of experiences, separated by several years, and one of them, of course, he had some missing time. Now, he wasn't sure that he was abducted, but it looks that way if you've read about abduction cases, that it was a good possibility. You know, I would love for this guy to maybe go under hypnosis to see what else he could remember, but you know, it was just a good story. And the way he described the first object he saw, I always will remember this. He said it reminded him of a Norelco razor. You know what I'm talking about, electric razor, where it's shaped sort of triangular with the three rotors. For those folks, especially for the men out there that shave and have electric razors, they know what I'm talking about. And I thought this was interesting because this was from the 60s. Late 60s when he had that. And now you see more triangular-shaped UFOs reported. You know, in the past, there were what we called flying saucers, circular, or maybe even cigar-shaped, football-shaped. But it seems like we're seeing more triangular shapes out there now. And he saw this many years ago before I'd heard of other people seeing the triangular shapes.
Yeah, that...
Go ahead.
My next question was going to be about Campbell.
Okay.
And so I guess I can skip that one.
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, I got ahead of you there. But
oh, that's okay.
But, yeah, the Mingo County stories, let's see here. Yeah, of course, that's my home county. So, you know, it's hard to say what the favorite is. Maybe one I can remember about a retired coal miner and his wife coming home from church on a Sunday night, which, of course, this is the Bible Belt, so a lot of people, again, these folks, many of them are so very religious people, you know, they're not the kind that are going to make up stories. And he talked about this UFO that they saw that was so huge that when he looked up, you know, it walked out the stars. And then, it was, again, I said, we live right on the border, so he said it was all the way from the West Virginia side across the river over to Kentucky. It was that huge. And it's amazing because you hear more of that now, sort of like with the Phoenix lights out there, how big it was and how people have described it. And again, this was many years ago. So, you know, people that are living all 50 states, other countries, have had the similar sightings, you know. And it's amazing to me that, you know, there's people that actually don't believe, because there's just too many credible people out there that have saw similar objects and had similar sightings and have similar stories, and it's just amazing.
That's the one that the chapter is titled The UFO in the Family Graveyard?
Let's see. Let me look in here.
For the triangular-shaped craft?
No, this one was, it's in chapter 2, the one I was just talking about.
Oh, okay.
Mingo County couple witnessed UFO. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah.
I was going to ask about the UFO in the family graveyard with the triangle craft.
Okay.
I forget which chapter that one was.
Yeah.
I have to go back and look.
I'm having to look. So see if you can find it and let me know, because
I've
been working on the other book. It's all the stories are starting to come together. I'm trying to remember which one was the graveyard. Yeah.
Chapter 13.
13.
Page 67. I thought that one was quite interesting. It was fairly recent.
Oh, yeah.
July 26, 2007.
Yeah, that was a more recent one, which, is, again, I had some from as far back as the 60s and then some that were more current. Yeah, and I've gotten this one from, I think I found it on the Internet and was able to contact these people with the their recollection of the story. But, again, yeah, very interesting. What would you like to know on that in particular?
Well, you know, it's obviously that it's from a younger individual. I mean, not a middle-aged
right
person, but you know, he was with some friends in he see it? Did they all see that? Did they all talk about it, or just the one person?
They all saw it, but basically just the one person wanted to talk about it. You know, again, that comes from, again, some people are, they just won't talk about it because they're afraid that people are going to make fun of them, or, you know, that they're just hesitant, like I said before, to share their stories. But I think that, and I hope you agree, maybe some of the listeners will agree, but that's starting to change. You know, just this past week, and I'm sure you saw this story because you're like me, you probably get online and watch the national news every day looking for these kind of stories. When Dr. Edgar Mitchell, the former astronaut, came out at the Washington Press Club at the conference in Washington, D.C. this past Monday, and he came out and said, you know, hey, Roswell really happened, you know, UFOs, aliens, they're real. You know, I'm tired of keeping it secret. He said he was privy to some government information, naturally, with him being a military officer and a former astronaut. So he's coming out, and I think more and more people like him that are, you know, very credible, that have actually know the truth about this phenomena, are coming out and sharing what they know and their information, and I think maybe the government is slowly acclimating their citizens to come out and tell us the truth in the near future. You know, Britain and Denmark recently, last year, released their secret UFO files that they had, and I think other countries are starting to do that. And with President Obama now, who really believes in the Freedom of Information Act and doesn't like the government keeping secrets, they've already been a request put forth to his administration to release some of this information and to let us know the truth. And I hope that once that actually happens, I think you'll have more and more people that will come out and share their stories. I think there's a lot of people out there that have had sightings or have had maybe abduction experiences, but they haven't told anyone because they were afraid or they didn't want people to make fun of them. And I think that's going to change real soon.
I certainly hope so. And in regards to Edgar Mitchell, he's actually been very public,
exactly,
with what he knows of the UFO subject, at least since I heard him speak in Roswell, New Mexico, oh gosh, it'll be 5 years ago this July.
Oh, really?
Where he openly said that his contacts in the Pentagon told him, you know, that yes, an object went down in the deserts of New Mexico in 1947, that yes, it was recovered, and that yes, so were bodies.
Exactly.
And it just irks me for the mainstream media to just now, 5 years later...
5 years later, exactly.
...make a big deal about it.
Well, you know, and he was on a radio show last year. I think it was actually in England.
Mm-hmm.
And you probably heard recordings of that.
Yes.
And, you know, he said he actually saw one. If I correct me if I'm wrong, he saw one land when he was out on a training mission.
That was Gordon Cooper.
Oh, is that Gordon? Okay, I get.
Yes,
yeah,
Mitchell
okay,
hasn't
Gordon.
Had any sightings of his own.
Okay, you're right. That was Gordon Cooper. But still, again, another astronaut. You know, another government person that has highly trained. You know, basically scientists that have come out and said, you know, that this phenomenon is real. And like you said, the mainstream media, they don't hardly touch it for some reason. It makes you wonder who's pulling the strings behind the scenes, you know. Maybe they're not supposed to touch it, or, you know, as in the past when we got our stories from the tabloids, you know, at least now some reputable news agencies are starting to make report on this. I know Edgar Mitchell's report and the speech he made this past week was on CNN, and they mentioned it on Fox News, too. So.
At the X conference, which was this last weekend.
Right.
And their press conference was Monday morning. That's where all of the networks, CNN and Fox News and all that, got their material.
Right.
The recent material, I should say, from Edgar Mitchell.
Right.
But when at the press conference, there was another individual with him, and, oh gosh, for the life of me, I can't remember his name. But he was a F-86D pilot. About the time of the Korean War, and he came out with his story about being sent out to go and intercept when he was stationed in England. And the guy got rather choked up that because of the fact that he now felt safe enough to tell his story without worry of the government coming back and saying, hey, you broke your security oath.
Exactly. I talked, there was one high-ranking official that I talked to, and I can't, you know, give his name because I swore to him that I wouldn't. And I was hoping he would talk to me on the record for my book, but again, he would not talk on the record. But he told me, he said, I'm sworn to secrecy. That's a quote, and you know, that tells me right there, he had something to tell, but he took that oath seriously. Because of his patriotism and his work for the military, and he did not want to come forward and reveal any of that information. I think maybe the fact that Dr. Edgar Mitchell and Gordon Cooper, some of these guys are getting older, and they realize that, hey, we're not going to be here much longer. We want to come out and tell the truth now. And I think we're going to see more of that. At least I hope we do.
Okay. Therese, the host for A Global Focus, just posted in our virtual auditorium that gentleman's name was Milton Torres.
Okay.
He's retired Air Force Major. It was a very interesting story that this gentleman had. Kind of tying Edgar Mitchell and your book back together.
Okay.
On your sighting 11, you have a quote here from Edgar Mitchell where he says, we all know that UFOs are real. All we need to ask is, where do they come from?
Right.
Now, is that poignant or what?
Exactly. I mean, pretty much as you said, says, hey, we know they're out there. Now we need to know, solve the mystery. Where are they coming from? And that would be a good question. I know you would love to know. I would love to know. All the ufologists and anybody that's interested in the subject would love to know. You know, I saw something the other day just surfing the net that some astronomers just found another planet out there that we didn't know about. And they said it may even be Earth-like. So there you go. I mean, we have no idea how many planets out there that exist that could sustain life and that could be highly advanced and already be traveling, you know, at the speed of light or even through other dimensions, however they're getting here. It's unfathomable for us to even think about.
I have a two-pronged question here from our virtual auditorium.
Okay.
First part is, was your news editor okay with you touching on this subject? Was he supportive? Also, have you noticed a change in the media's attitude since the O'Hare incident?
Actually, when I was just a reporter working for an editor, they probably wouldn't have been as reluctant to let me write about the subject, but they did a couple cases. But I became an editor myself, so I had a little bit more freedom, which that, of course, helps when you can call the shots. What was the other part of the question again?
Have you noticed a change in the media's attention, or attitude, rather, since the O'Hare Airport incident?
Yeah, I think we are seeing some changes. You mentioned Joyner, who reported on the Stephenville, Texas sightings. Of course, she lost her job at that newspaper, and I think that's terrible because somebody put pressure on her to quit reporting about it. But on the other hand, she appeared on Larry King. Larry King had a couple of episodes dedicated just to the Stephenville, Texas sightings. He's had other UFO. He's had, you know, Whitley Strieber and other people on. I think he's had maybe had Dr. Mitchell too. Other people on. So some of those folks are slowly starting to report this kind of news, but there's still a lot of them out there that won't touch it.
I'm seeing a lot of change in it as well.
Yeah.
Personally, I love hearing stories from the 50s.
Yeah.
And you have one from 1955 recalled by Mary Bias, I believe is how her name's pronounced.
Yeah, that was wasn't her real name. Again, some people didn't want me to use their real names, but, you know, so I would change it to get their story, for them to agree to give me their story. But, I remember that one. What chapter are you on there?
Oh, gosh. Again, I have to go through the book.
I'm sorry.
It's all in my notes. I don't even remember the name of the incident. Oh,
okay,
gosh. I was just writing notes as I was going.
Sighting 7.
Pardon?
Yeah, I think it's chapter 7.
Ah, yes.
55, right? Yeah. Page 49.
Yep, that's it.
Okay. Yeah, Mary Bias. Again, a real reputable witness. I knew this person personally, and she found out that I was interested in the subject. And once they do, they're more willing to share their stories. And that was the case of this lady. And again, she had more than just herself. Her parents also saw it. And as you mentioned, sometimes they're not always going to report it, but in this case, she said they actually called the local law enforcement agency at that time. And then years later, when she heard about Project Blue Book, she looked up during that year to see if anything else had been sighted around the time that she saw hers. So, again, another really interesting story there.
You want to tell a little bit more about what happened?
Sure. Let's see. Let me refresh myself here. She was young, 16. Sort of sounded like what happened with me when I was younger and sitting with my parents and my sister on the front porch. Almost sounded similar story. It was summer. They were sitting outside and were basically astonished once they saw this cigar-shaped object just floating motionless over the mountain. Then when it, and like in most cases, when it took off, it just almost disappeared. It left so fast. And, of course, 1955, people were a little more scared of when they saw something like this. You know, I think a lot of it had to do with some of the science fiction movies that were coming out at that time. You know, The Day the Earth Stood Still, that came out in the 50s. Some of those, and some of the books that were starting to be written. We were, you know, in the Cold War. We'd just come out of the World War II and then Korean War, and people were worried what was out there, and the whole way they thought about things, it was a little more scary for them. And I think that's one reason the government has covered those stories up, especially from Roswell on through the 50s, because they were worried about how people would react. I mean, look at what happened with Orson Welles and his radio show, War of the Worlds, when he did it on Halloween, there was people that thought it was true. They didn't hear the disclaimers at the beginning. And then when they tuned in, you know, you had literal panic because people thought we were being invaded by Martians with lasers. So, you know, people would have panicked. And I think that's one reason the government tried to keep this under wraps. But for one thing, they didn't know what they were dealing with, and they didn't want the everyday average citizen to know this was out there, because they would have panicked, and then it would have changed the whole way people thought. I mean, you know, the 50s, it was an innocent time. You're talking about, you know, like Father Knows Best and Andy Griffith, those kind of, that's what pictures I picture from the 50s. And people would have theologically and sociologically, the way they would think would have changed, and it may even do so now, but I don't think as much as it did would have done 50 years ago.
I mentioned that they did call the police. What was the attitude the police had?
Basically, probably thought somebody was, you know, silly, that it was a prank call, or that, you know, you didn't really see anything, you know. And they do, what would they have done if they would have believed it, you know? So they didn't get much reaction, you know. Like, you know, what do you want us to do? So,
gosh, how frustrating that would be.
Exactly. And, you know, I'm sure it even happens today somewhat, but maybe people are maybe, you know, a good friend of mine, Steve Hammonds, he's a UFO writer out in your neck of the woods, out west there. And he writes a lot of articles, and they appear on his website, and also they appear on UFO Digest on their website. And he wrote an article, and he ran across a fire training manual from, I think it was Cincinnati, Ohio, which is where he was originally from. And in that manual, there was a whole chapter devoted to what to do in the event of if there was a UFO crash. And I bet you that there's a lot of other training manuals out there, government-wise and emergency services, that this has these kind of chapters, but, again, a lot of people don't know about it. But, you know, they have things in there, you know, that they need to maybe worry about, radiation and other things. So if those exist in these emergency services manuals, then it just shows you, again, more evidence, even though some may think it's circumstantial, that these exist, you know, these stories exist, that UFOs exist. And so, you know, of course, at that time in the 50s, they probably had nothing like that because they didn't know what to do. But now, I think there has been some training, and there's, you know, there's probably some government agencies we don't even know about that would show up and investigate these kind of things. Of course, we always heard about the Men in Black, but that's another whole story.
It's interesting you would bring up the firefighters training manual. Gosh, about a year ago, maybe a little longer, there was a commercial that they had been playing on local radio and TV for firefighting training courses. And there was a phone number there. And I was wondering if they were using that particular manual. So I called them to ask.
Right.
And the individual I spoke to didn't know. He wasn't the one that was going to be teaching the course. But he did take my name and phone number down and said that he would ask the instructor and would get back to me. I'm still waiting for them to get back to me.
I'm glad you said that. That's something that I was going to do, too. I have connections with the local fire department here. And it's a small town, but they are a paid fire department. And I'm sure they have a training manual, because years ago I was actually a volunteer fireman, one of the many things I've done. I'm going to go by there. It's a note that I've made, a mental note, to see if they have this manual and just ask them if I can look through it and to see if they have a chapter in there. You know, if this is something that maybe since 9/11 especially, if these training manuals have been sent out to a lot of the emergency services and fire departments and crews all across the nation. And if it's there, because if it's in one, you would think it's in some of the others. So you do that. You keep trying, and I'll try too. We'll let each other know.
I'm not sure the exact year it was published. I believe it was 1990 something. I'm sure someone here in the virtual auditorium knows,
right,
and will get it posted. But if I remember correctly, that manual was published by FEMA. Now, if I'm wrong again, somebody in our auditorium will probably correct me.
I think that's what I had read, and if I was had it in front of Steve's article, and somebody maybe, if they're surfing the net, Google Steve Hammonds, and you maybe can find his website. He's got several articles, and there's one, and they may be able to find it. I'm sure, I'm like you, I think it was published by FEMA, and it was an official government, you know, training manual.
Yeah, it was really great. I heard about that. In your book, each sighting report has a UFO-related quote.
Yeah.
I think two of my favorites are the one from Story Musgrove, and I kind of had to chuckle, but even one from Dennis Weaver.
Yeah. The late Dennis Weaver. I think he's passed now. But, yeah, I found some of those, and now I'm going to do the same thing with this new book. And, you know, a lot of famous people have interest in UFOs, and you mentioned Dennis Weaver. Of course, he was an actor, TV actor. He was on, Gunsmoke, and then McCloud. It was made some movies. Dan Aykroyd, who's of Saturday Night Live fame, is a UFO believer and has even written some things about it. Something I always bring up when I've talked to a couple of civic clubs about my book, and, you know, I know some of those guys, especially some of the older ones, middle-aged or maybe raising their eyebrows, and I'll tell them, Ronald Reagan reported seeing a UFO. He was on Air Force One and even had the pilot chase one. Jimmy Carter, another president, reported seeing a UFO. So again, you've got a lot of credible witnesses, even presidents that reported seeing UFOs. You've got actors, you've got firemen, policemen. There's been a lot of...
Astronauts.
Exactly. Of course, astronauts, as we mentioned earlier with Gordon Cooper, and I'm sure others. And other famous people. Of course, something I wrote a commentary in this new book because of the mainstream and how we mentioned that maybe they're slowly acclimating American citizens about UFOs. I'm sure you, unlike many of the other listeners, if you were like me, were watching some of the presidential debates last year. Did you see the one where Tim Russert asked the congressman from Ohio, Dennis Kucinich, about...
Yes, he did.
Yeah, he says he saw a UFO. He was with Shirley MacLaine, the famous actress at the time. And, of course, she saw it, too. Of course, she's a believer. So here's a guy that was a presidential candidate. It came up in the presidential debate, this question. And, of course, Bill Richardson from out there in the West, Arizona, he actually is, I think, when he was governor... or a congressman, I can't remember at the time, but he tried to get the Roswell files released. Exactly. So, you know, again, there's people out there that want to know and that believe, and it's not just a guy, it's, you know, the old stereotype, two guys in a pickup truck with a six-pack riding down the road that saw a UFO, you know. There's many more credible witnesses, you know, doctors. One of the stories in here, I think his name is Walt, he grew up and he was a doctor. He is a doctor now, you know, and he saw a UFO when he was younger with his family, you know. And so again, these are very intelligent people and very credible, and that's something I keep wanting to stress.
Oh, gosh, I was just looking for that one.
Yeah, I'll try to find it here. And
oh, that's all right.
Which one it is.
And then you have, people from all age ranges.
Yeah.
you know, telling their stories, which I think is great. And then again, you say, like, well, there's an educator in here, a teacher, a doctor. Gosh, I think there was even a farmer in here, if I remember correctly. So someone.
Exactly. So it's very diverse, like you say, with the age of the folks. Some of them were young, some of them were older, middle-aged, and then all kinds of occupations. Yeah, the one lady was a school teacher. A couple of them, I think, actually, maybe. The one story, let me see, I think it's 16, maybe. Yeah, the Orange Spear at Point Pleasant. That lady was a school teacher. And, again, a credible witness. And this was the same area where they had a lot of sightings over the years. This is Point Pleasant, Mason County, was where Mothman was, the story came out of that area. But after, you know, we got off track, I think, a little bit. You know, with Mothman, there were also, at the same time, a lot of UFO sightings at that time. And a lot of people sort of connected the two together, whether they were or not, but a lot of people did. And then the Men in Black, some of the people there, one of the ladies that was one of the original reporters of this, she was a newspaper writer up there in that area. These guys came in suits, you know, black Linnean cars, and they were coming around questioning people. You know, again, that's, people, of course, said they were government agents probably coming in trying to investigate or hush up the stories. But another interesting case there.
I have another question from our virtual auditorium. Tall Dwarf asks, if there are underground bases in West Virginia, what are the best possible locations, or what is the best possible location or locations for them, and any reports of things?
Well, there's one we know about for sure. The secret came out. It's under the Greenbrier Resort Hotel. And if you go online, you can find out about it. In fact, UFO Hunters, two or three weeks ago, had an episode where they went to the Greenbrier. These bunkers were built, and those people that say that underground bunkers they can't be there. Well, yeah, they can, because there's one that you can actually go tour now. Greenbrier is a resort hotel. I mean, it's like a 4 or 5 star hotel with a golf course, more expensive than I could afford. But there's a bunker there, and that was built to house Congress if there was a nuclear war. They had beds in there. They had a 2 or 3 month supply of food, water, communication equipment, and that it was right there, really, as, you know, under the hotel. There was an entrance to it, but nobody really knew what, you know. They say the best way to keep something secret is to have it right out in front where somebody could see it. And it's there. It exists. And I'm sure there's others. I've always heard that there were other bunkers in West Virginia, because we are real mountainous, and you go up into the Blue Ridge Mountain area, which we border Virginia and West Virginia, and some very large mountainous areas and very remote. And there's been reports over the years there was other bunkers built. There was one that was built for the president and his cabinet. There was one for the U.S. Senate. And, of course, we've got the one that we know about, that is near at the Greenbrier Resort in Greenbrier County, that was built for Congress. I mean, it's there. It exists. I mean, you know, people have seen it. You can go up there every so often. They give tours now. So it's there. They exist. And I'm sure there's others. As we said, our area is remote, but if you go out west and Area 51 and some of the other places, there's probably other underground bunkers that we don't know about. And, you know, naturally, they're going to keep those secrets.
Any idea on where would be a good location for one?
Your own little gut feeling? I would say on the border of Virginia, West Virginia, the Blue Ridge Mountains, that is in a close proximity to Washington, D.C. That way, if they did have to get, say, the president out or wherever, it wouldn't take them probably a few minutes by air helicopter to get to that undisclosed location. Any particular, I don't know, you know, to say what near what town or whatever, but I'm sure there are there that we have no idea where, and it's probably good that we don't know. I mean, you know, when 9/11, you know, when that happened, you know, they got vice president Dick Cheney out of the White House through an underground bunker. I don't know how many people know that. And got him out of there, him and his and some of his staff. Of course, Bush was down in Florida reading to the those kids at the time at the grade school. And then
here's another quick one. Let's see, we've got about 4 minutes till we go to the break. Let's see if we can get the answer to this one in. Cy Poet, who is also a friend of mine that I know lives in West Virginia, by the way.
Oh, great.
She asks about the Rockefeller Estate in the mountains.
And I really don't know much about it, to be honest. Of course, Jay Rockefeller is our U.S. Senator, or one of the U.S. Senators here. He came here in the 60s as a Vista worker. Of course, his family were politicians. He came working for that poverty program and ended up staying and working his way up through the political ranks. He was like a local House of Delegate member, and he then ended up becoming Secretary of State, and then Governor, and now U.S. Senator. And he does still own property. I do know that, in West Virginia, and I know he had a big farm or estate somewhere, but I can't remember what county he did.
She just expanded on her question a bit. She says it's a remote place, and she wonders if anything might be there.
That's a possibility, I guess. You know, he's on the Intelligence Committee of the Senate, so maybe he let them build a bunker near his property. Who knows? I mean,
that would be interesting.
That would be interesting. Yeah.
Saying you can build it on my property as long as there's a place for me.
As long as I can stay there, you know.
Oh, gosh, that would be interesting, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it would. It really would.
Have, you know, say, hey, come use my land. You know, just include me in.
And I'm sure he owns thousands of acres because he bought a lot of property in West Virginia. I think he even had some reserve or stock in some coal mining. And, of course, the Rockefellers made their money through the oil industry, but he got into the coal mining business, too, from what I understand.
Gosh, that's an interesting thought.
Yeah.
Let's see. Gosh, I'm kind of trying to hold off on this, on what I want to get into next until after the break.
Okay.
We've got about a minute and a half till we go to break. Okay, tell you what. I'll do it this way.
Okay.
Your last segment in your book is, I guess, you and Stan Friedman discussing West Virginia UFOs. So
yeah.
Kind of like to set up the time and the location where this occurred, and then when we come back from the break, we can go further into it.
Yeah, that was super to get to talk to him. He was in West Virginia at a conference last September near our state capital in Charleston. I had contacted him via email, and he was just more than willing to meet with me over there. At that time, I was still working for a newspaper. I did an article for the newspaper, and then he agreed to let me, you know, do an interview and use some of it in the book, too. But we can expand more on it after the break.
Oh, that's awesome. That's great. I've met Stan several times, and I agree. He is a very nice guy, very easy to talk to.
Yeah.
Well, on that note, I suppose we could go ahead and go to break.
Sounds
and
good.
We'll be back here in, let's see, about 8 to 9 minutes here on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network, also on UPRN 105.3 in New Orleans, and you're listening to Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis. And welcome to back to Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis, here on UFO Paranormal Radio Network on UPRN 105.3 New Orleans. I'm your host, DeAndrew, and tonight we've been talking with Kyle Lovern, author of the book Appalachian Case Study, UFO Sightings, Alien Encounters, and Unexplained Phenomenon. Kyle, just before we went to the break, you kind of set up a little bit about the setting of where you got to interview Stan Friedman.
Go ahead.
He is such a cool guy. And you give a little bit of his background in here, but what were some of the things that he told you in the interview that really just astounded you?
Well, of course, I was in awe at first when I got to meet him. He came to Charleston, West Virginia, which is our state capital. There was a two-day UFO conference there with some authors and other people, and then he, of course, was the featured speaker each night, and it was just great to get to meet him. I'd found out he was going to be there, and I got on his website, and I emailed him thinking, well, you know, I might hear from him. It wasn't, you know, a couple minutes later, he emailed me right back. He was just was great, so graceful. And he, of course, agreed to meet with me there and do the interview. And I was editor for a group of weekly papers at that time, but that's changed. But I got to meet him, and, of course, I talked to him about the history of West Virginia, because that's what I was interested in. That's my home state. And he agreed that, you know, West Virginia did have a lot of history with the UFO cases. One he mentioned, and I haven't written about it, but I've done a little research on it. He was in Pennsylvania at that time working. Of course, he's a nuclear physicist. I'm sure most people out there know about Stan. Probably the guru of ufology as far as I'm concerned. He's just very intelligent and knows his stuff, as we were talking about in the break. But he talked about the Woodrow Derenberger case, and that was an abduction case that happened in West Virginia in the 60s, and he came down from Pennsylvania to investigate that. You can find it online if you go to Yahoo or Google and type in that name. It's a pretty interesting case, but I think it was a little far-fetched, to be honest, and Stan agreed. And that's why he didn't do much about it, and I didn't either. But he was familiar with the state. This actually was the second time that he had came here to this conference to talk about. He was really interested in the Braxton County monster. That's what they dubbed it. Again, it really was a UFO. It's known as the Braxton County monster only because the media, that's what they end up calling it, was a monster when it was really a UFO that was, I think the story goes, that it may have been actually shot at by U.S. Air Force jets and may have been a little crippled, and that's why it ended up landing there in West Virginia. But he was fascinated with that case and said there was a lot of good evidence with it and other cases. And he's a super guy. He was just great. He sat down with me and did the interview. And then the next night we got to go out and have dinner. And he's just very personable. I mean, you know, we went to dinner and we were just talking football, and he was asking a little bit about the state and the geography and things like that, and he's just, you won't find a better person in this field, and he just, I'm glad that I can say he's a friend, and I've continued to keep in contact with him since that time, and he's just, it was just great, you know, and it tickles me as to see him when I see any of the UFO documentaries on TV or some of the interviews with Larry King, and he's always on there, and the fact that I got to interview him, you know. And I've got a chapter in my book dedicated to him, and got my picture with him. I was like a kid in the candy shop.
I can relate.
Yeah.
The first time I met him was at Roswell, New Mexico. So
yeah, right there where he loves that case, of course, because he's one of the guys that broke that case and found Jesse Marcel before he passed away. And that was great.
Yeah, I equate that trip to as a pilgrimage to Mecca. Not only did I get to visit Roswell, I also got to speak with the gentleman that broke the case, if you want to put it that way. Interesting individual.
Great. I want to come to Roswell. I haven't been there yet, but that's one of my goals, is to come out there.
Oh, you're going to have to someday,
yeah,
or some July, rather, I should say. It's really a great festival, and they have, oh gosh, so many speakers speaking at three different venues.
I'm sure.
Amazing.
Yeah, definitely have to make it out there. You know, I mentioned the Braxton County Monster case. If you look in the book on page 95, there's a replica of what the eyewitnesses said that the probe looked like that they saw. And pictured in front of that is Freddie May, who was just a young boy at the time, and he's still alive. He's one of the probably the only surviving witnesses that saw this. And, you know, again, it made national news at the time, and I thought you might want to check that out.
Actually, I already had my finger there because I was looking to see what year the Braxton County incident happened, and that was in 1952.
Yeah.
52. So like you were saying, you know, 1952 is okay. Nobody was really using the term aliens.
Yeah, or even they were calling flying saucers maybe, but not UFOs, which is what we know now as an unidentified flying object. And then, again, the media, what happened was Freddie May's mother and one of the other witnesses, they were flown to New York and appeared on a national show, and they did an artist rendering, and it was totally different than what they said they saw, and they made it look like some kind of creature with claws, and that wasn't what they saw at all. Again, it was more like what you see in the book there, a probe for maybe a spaceship or something. And again, especially at that time, the media, and they dubbed it the Braxton County Monster when it was really a UFO. And again, it shows you how the media handled it at the time and how people did, and you know, how they also panicked.
That's true. Another incident that kind of comes to mind is the Kelly Hawkinsville, Kentucky.
Yeah.
Incident where they were saying it got dubbed the moonshine.
Yeah, I'm actually going to write about that in my second book only because of that, you know. But there's a lot of evidence that those folks that on that farm did see something, you know. Of course, they investigated it, but there were some folks on a farm, and you know, they apparently had an encounter with aliens and actually shot at them, which is probably what a lot of people would do even now. You know, everybody says, well, I wonder why they don't come around. And I said, well, what's the first thing a lot of people do? They pull out their gun and want to start shooting, you know. But that's what happened. And they shot up their house, you know. And
actually, I've had the daughter of, all I can remember is the last name, Sutton. Her name is Geraldine Stitt.
Uh-huh.
But her father was... why can't I remember his first name? The main son of the woman that owned the farm.
Let me see.
I can't think of his name.
Computer, I might be able to find it for you quick.
And she has a book out about that incident.
Oh, really?
Yes, it's very good, actually.
Okay.
I've had her on my program, and she's... if you like, after the show's over, I can give you her contact information.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Yes, and we met her in Roswell last year.
Oh, okay.
She had her book there.
Yeah, you know, as I mentioned earlier, this time I am spreading out a little bit. I've got that story that I'm recounting some of the stories, but I've got several new ones and from Kentucky, and a couple are really eerie. One,
ooh, I'd love to hear it.
Okay. One, then, again, credible witnesses, and it happened near Moorhead, Kentucky, which there's a Moorhead University, a college there. And there's was a college professor, actually, though he was a professor at from the University of Kentucky. He and his sons were driving home, and it was like in the late autumn, getting close toward Christmas, I guess, and they spotted a UFO as they were heading toward their little subdivision. And, you know, they parked in the driveway, went in their house, got up on the second floor where they could get a little bit higher and to see this. And in the meantime, there was another neighbor that had spotted it, and there was all the neighborhood dogs started going wild, barking and all this, and it was definitely, you know, people continued to see this UFO. But then when the UFO sort of disappeared over a little hill, like they think it landed in a little valley, they heard these blood-curdling screams, and they call called the emergency services. The Kentucky State Police showed up. The fire department showed up. They're out searching then because people heard these screams. They're trying to see where these screams came from, which were associated with this UFO sighting. And, you know, I'm, of course, I'm can't even get a lot of detail of it, but it's just a real interesting case, and it's really eerie, I think, the fact that there was, you know, there was just a lot of, and there were several credible witnesses, and the fact that it's, you know, it's on record with 911 and you know, emergency services. They made the call, and they came out there and tried to find out what was going on, and, you know, it's just a real strange case. And,
you know, I believe I've read about that case.
You probably have, because you can get, there's a little short, like a documentary on YouTube. If you go to YouTube and type in Moorhead, Kentucky, it's like a little 10-minute documentary that talks about it. You can, it's pretty good. And it
wasn't it a woman's voice yelling, like,
yeah,
help me, or
exactly,
something like that?
Yeah, like, oh, God, help me, you know, and screaming and just blood curdling. Yeah, it was a female voice. But they never could figure out, you know, if someone was being abducted or what. But it's real eerie, you know.
Oh, I can't wait to read about that one, because
yeah,
that one just kind of,
yeah, it just sort of,
you know, you just read a little bit about it,
and
it just kind of disappeared.
To get into detail and talk about it, and it was really investigated by MUFON and the National UFO Reporting Center. I talked to Peter Davenport from the National UFO Reporting Center. He said it was definitely a good case, that, you know, that there was definitely something to it, and, you know, one of those that was, again, documentation with emergency services. I mean, they came out, and the name, I tried to get a hold of the professor, and I did finally manage to contact him, but he doesn't like to talk about it. I think it really just creeped him out, you know, and but, I mean, again, another credible witness, because this guy's a college professor. So, you know, and he and his two sons that were, I think, college-age themselves were witness to this UFO, and then several other people in the neighborhood saw the UFO and heard the screams. And, you know, it's a good case. There's another one that where a train, an engine of a train, coal train, it's over in near Paintsville, Kentucky, and supposedly this train was struck one late one night, early one morning, by a UFO. And again, you think cover up when you read about this story. Another good case. It's just, I mean, again, they keep coming in now. I'll probably collect enough stories to start another book after this, because I had to wrap this one up because I'm limited to how many words the publisher wanted on this one, but it's just amazing how many stories are out there and how many people have seen something or have heard or know somebody else that saw something, you know. And I'm just amazed. I've got some more stories again from West Virginia. One I liked, let me just share this one with you. This one's really... it still touches my heart. It's sad. A lady contacted me through, we had a mutual friend, and she was originally from the same county here where I live, Mingo County. But in the 60s, a lot of people from here, because there wasn't a lot of work, moved north to Detroit in that area to get jobs in the automotive industry. Some of them moved to Chicago and Columbus, but a lot of people moved up to Michigan. And she's a very good witness, and her son died of a brain tumor after having an experience with a UFO in their backyard. A light beamed down on him and one of his friends, and it wasn't even a year later that he died of a brain tumor. And she really believes that there's some kind of connection to the fact where this UFO hovered over them one night when they were out playing in the snow. She let them go out and play in the snow because I was, you know, wasn't going to be any school the next day because it was like a blizzard. And then he gets sick, and she just really thinks that maybe this UFO and maybe the fact he was even abducted, that had something to do with his eventual death. And it's really sad, and it's, you know, when you hear about something like that, and but it's a good story. And,
that wouldn't be the first time that people's death had been attributed to a close encounter.
Exactly, and we, of course, can't prove it, but, you know, they're good, credible witnesses. Her name's Thelma Jackson. She may even be listening tonight because I've continued to stay in contact with her. I hope she is, and Bernard is just a really sweet lady, and, you know, again, that one touched me because of the fact that they, you know, lost their son, and she's just been interested in UFOs ever since. They had a couple of sightings up there and where they lived at the time. And even though it was in Michigan, which technically wasn't Appalachia, I included it because they were from this area. And actually, they've retired and moved back to West Virginia. And she shared her story with me, and we've continued to stay in touch. Another one, I've had a couple of stories in this one of people that were working out in coal mine areas, and the miners see it. And of course, a lot of mines work three shifts, so a lot of times they're out in the evening or on the third shift, and that they have seen UFOs. And one who was related to Thelma, he worked at what they call a mountaintop removal coal mine or strip mine, and he shared the story with me, and there was like 40 other people that saw this UFO one night when he was the superintendent of the job site where they were doing some mountaintop removal. And he shared that story with me. Again, a good, credible witness. And there's just going to be some great stories in this next book. Just trying to get down through my laptop here and see some of them.
You know, I should have asked this quite a while ago, but silly me, didn't think about it. What's the name of your new book?
Well, tentatively right now I'm going to call it Appalachian Case Study Part 2, Mysterious UFO Sightings and Alien Abductions. So I'm going to make it sort of like a sequel to this one, but maybe change it up a little bit, unless the publisher changes my mind, and that's very possible. Because I was going to call the first one something else, and he came up with this name, and I thought it was good, because it encompassed all of Appalachian, and especially this one does. So I mentioned to you earlier that I got contacted from a guy from California. He had lived in Virginia at the time. They had a really good sighting, and I've got a couple of Virginia stories this time that are real good. One near Withville, Virginia, but you may have heard about that because there were several sightings in the 80s, you know, around Withville and Hillsville, Virginia. Again, there's just been lots of sightings in Appalachia, and I don't think a lot of them have been heard about before, and that's one thing I wanted to do is try to get these stories out there. Got another one. I'm working in, again, my manuscript here, Chapter 10 of a woman who probably had an abduction experience, and it's really eerie once you listen to her, and you know, you almost think that she had screen memories because of the way she remembers the incident, but she didn't panic at the time. But then as she recalled them later on, it's just, again, real eerie. She was living alone with her daughter in a little rural area. And it really sounds like she was probably abducted. So there's just so many good cases out there, and I want to try to share them with the people out there that believe. And, you know, the more stories we can hear from people, the more that we can get the word out.
Sci Poet, again, my friend in West Virginia, wanted to know if you have any stories from the northern part of West Virginia. That's where she's at.
I have one, actually, in this new book that it was from Benwood, West Virginia. I think it's near Wheeling. That a guy contacted me that had a pretty good story. And then I'm also going to, as I mentioned to you earlier, do a chapter on the Kecksburg incident, which was right near the West Virginia border up in the northern part. You know, Morgantown is only like maybe an hour away from Pittsburgh, and Kecksburg's probably between Morgantown and Pittsburgh. So those are from up there. Yeah, this guy from Benwood had gotten my first book, and he contacted me through the publisher and had a pretty good little story, a couple of stories from up in that area. So those are the two that I can think of right off the top of my head.
She just posted that she lives in Harrison County.
Harrison, Clarksburg, yeah. I've heard there have been a couple sightings up there in that area. I don't think I have any actually in my books, but hopefully I can.
She said she had met Gary Barker many years ago.
Oh, yeah. Gray Barker is actually how it is.
Oh, excuse me. Gray Barker.
Yeah.
Oh, guys.
You were mentioning earlier the Hopkinsville, Kentucky. Their last name was Taylor. Is that Ann Sutton?
Yes.
Yeah, Sutton, yeah. That was, yeah, the Suttons and Taylors were the two families were there. That was from 55. Again, you're like me. I sort of like those stories from that era because, you know, again, they weren't as inundated with pictures of aliens and UFOs like we are now. At that time, they'd hardly ever heard of it. Some people didn't even have TV. So, you know, again, if they saw something and they described it, and it's sort of the same thing that we see this day and age, it makes you wonder.
I'm fascinated with the history of ufology.
Yeah.
Also here in the auditorium, it was mentioned that Hynek investigated the Kelly and Hopkinsville incident.
Yeah.
The history of the early years, and I use the term early years rather
right.
loosely, because we all know this goes way back.
Oh, yeah, because you mentioned Van Doniken earlier, you know, the ancient astronauts, but that gets
mm-hmm.
into another whole interview probably.
Oh, definitely. But, you know, the modern history of ufology is something that I have studied since I was a little kid. And these older stories are the ones I grew up with, and they hold kind of a special place in my ufology heart here.
Yeah.
And you know, because, gosh, a lot of these happened before I was even born.
Exactly, yeah, me too.
You know, and I think that was the golden years of the start of modern ufology.
You know, I'm glad you brought that up. I was going to trigger a memory here for me. As far as the history, you know, I know out west they've had some, I think it's the Hopi Indians maybe.
Yes.
There's been some talk about they had some early sightings and some stories from their elders and storytellers. I ran across one story, and again, I got to thank Steve Hammonds. He sort of shared this one with me and let me rewrite it for my next book. But in this neck of the woods, you had the Cherokee tribe, and they were in parts of Kentucky and West Virginia, and, of course, down in Tennessee and North Carolina, where they still have reservations. But, of course, they eventually, the white man pushed them out west, to Oklahoma, which is the Trail of Tears. You probably heard about that.
Mm-hmm.
But I've got a story. It's called The Disc in the Meadow, and it was an old story that he had discovered about a Cherokee tribe that had saw what we know as a flying saucer UFO land when they were out on hunting, and I had an encounter with some aliens. Even going back that far, I mean, it's amazing when you think about it. You know,
oh, wow.
You think about some of the cave drawings they've seen in other places, and like in down in the Mayan country down in Central America and Mexico. I think we can go back pretty far with some of the history of that these UFOs and aliens have been here for a while.
Oh, yes.
And as
yes,
you say,
I think they've been watching us from the beginning.
Exactly. I think so, too. Whether we're an experiment for them or what the case, fascinating.
And you want to tell everybody when your new book comes out?
Yeah, it's probably going to come out late summer, early fall. I'm thinking around the end of September, 1st of October. At least that's what the publisher and I talked about. And by the way, I want to thank my publisher, if I haven't mentioned him. It's Woodland Press. And it's a small company that was dedicated to publishing West Virginia and Appalachian authors who had trouble getting published. And they've just been super. Keith Davis and his wife Cheryl are the owners, and they've just been super to work with and just great with booking book signings and other things and doing a great job with the layout and everything, and you know, and they've got the book. By the way, anybody that is, if you don't have it and you're interested in buying it, I appreciate it. You can go to their website, woodlandpress.com, or the way most people get their books now, unless they go to the bookstores like you, go to Amazon.com or BarnesandNoble.com, and then just type in my name, Kyle Lovern, last name spelled L-O-V-E-R-N, and it'll come up, or Appalachian Case Study, UFO Sightings, Alien Encounters, and then I'm sure it'll come up. So if you want to check it out, I'd love for you to get it. And I think if you, after you read the first one, you'll want to read the second one, because I've already had some people that read the first one are real anxious for me to come out with the next one, so it won't be much longer.
Oh, gosh, I'm already anxious.
Yeah, in fact, I actually sent the manuscript to him last night.
Oh, great.
I finished it up, and I sent it to him, so now it's in their hands, so whenever they can decide to get it ready and bring it out. So hopefully sooner than later, but definitely it'll be this year. So.
We'll
probably,
have to get you back
summer.
Talking about that one.
I will definitely, I'll send you a copy, and we'll get back on your radio show this fall and talk about it. And you can, after you read some of those stories, we can talk about some of those that I've mentioned and several more. This one's going to be even more. There's going to be more stories in this one and some pictures that I've taken myself. There's some folks that went on record, you know, which makes it, as you said earlier, even more credible. And they're willing to come out on record and it's just amazing, you know. I really appreciative of these folks when you go out and interview them, and they're willing to do that too. Because you know, they're, you know, being from a rural area, small town, sometimes they may not want to stick their necks out. But again, I think the stereotype is changing, and people don't care to come out on record and share their stories now. Hopefully it's going to change even more.
Are you seeing, as I am, that the subject, you know, not in the mainstream media, but just in the general population, is starting to lose a lot of the giggle factor, stigma?
Yeah, I definitely do. I'll share a story with you. I went to my bank the other day to make a deposit, and the young lady, the teller, she looked up at me and she said, "Are you the guy that wrote the book?" And I said, "Yeah," because you never know what to expect in this situation, you know. But this is the kind of experiences I've had. And I said, "Yeah." She said, "Well, I was just up at the bookstore." She said, "I saw that book." She said, "I'm going to go back and buy it." And she said, "I saw a UFO a few years ago," you know, and she's looking around to see if any of the other tellers are listening, but you know, she started sharing her story with me, and that's happening all the time now. And she, you know, was talking about her cousin was staying all night with, and that her aunt called, who lived a couple houses away, and said, "You got to come outside and see this." And that the whole neighborhood watched the UFO for about 15 minutes. This happened like in the 80s. Again, that's another story that I'm going to go back and talk to her more in depth for a future story. But this is happening, and people are starting to share with them, with me, and I'm sure other people. And yeah, they're not. And the other people that were listening, they didn't giggle. As you said, they were just listening, and it's like they're interested. And then another guy stopped me on the street the other day. I was walking down the street, and we were just talking, and he's like, "Well, you know, I saw a UFO once." And then another guy was standing there, and he looked. At first he smiled, but then as this guy started talking, the smile just got serious, and he's like, "This guy's serious. He's telling it." And again, so yeah, it's definitely... It's a lot different than it was even 20 years ago, let alone 40 or 50 years ago.
Exactly. What inspired you to write these books? I mean, was it the people or just a desire to share the information? Or
one of my goals, I guess, personal goals, I always wanted to be published as far as having a book published. And, of course, I've been published as a newspaper a writer, and then I've had magazine articles and things published. I mean, I'm into sport. I love sports, so I've written sports for years, too, but I got into news. And again, it was something I was interested in, and I've collected these. And then, you know, I've never lost interest. I sort of like you. I've always continued to read about it and collect stories and information. And I became familiar with my publisher because we were working together. And he had done mostly Appalachian historical books, like on the Hatfield-McCoy feud. I know a lot of people have heard those, and some things like that. And he did he'd written a murder mystery himself, which was a true story in a neighboring county, which is real good. But he had published a couple of books about West Virginia legends. Most of them were ghost stories, because there's been a lot of ghost stories here in the Mountain State too. And I told him, I said, look, I thought about putting this book together. I've got all these stories about UFOs. He said, what do you think? And then I was like, he said, well, you know, give me your manuscript, you know, put it together, and we'll look at it. I did, and he liked it, and he said, hey, we'll go for it. And he published it for me, and it's starting to catch on a little bit now, just like with your show all the way out there in Arizona and down in New Orleans, which is great. And the word's getting out. I had a book review on UFO Digest. I saw that the other day, and they it was a real good review. They had it as their top book on their website, and that was just great. And I don't want to toot my own horn. It's just the fact that the word's starting to get out there, and people, and it's just something I always wanted to accomplish, really. But it's starting to catch on, and I'm just tickled to death, as we would say here in West Virginia. And I just want to continue to do it. It's something I always wanted to do, and I finally got brave enough to come out with this subject matter for a book. And you know, I didn't care what anybody else saw or thought. And you know, I've been on a couple of local radio stations, and now on your station, and hope to get on some more. I'd like to get on some other national shows and let people know what I've got to offer.
I think you're doing a darn good job.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. And
I enjoyed reading this.
I'm glad you called me, or you contacted the publisher, and then he contacted me, and I contacted you, and we got to schedule this show. I mean, it really pleased me to hear from you that night when we scheduled this. And it was just great. I've told a lot of people about it, so hopefully you got some new listeners tonight.
we're heard over, gosh, not just here in Arizona and in Louisiana, but you know, we've got truly an international audience.
Yeah, a national audience, so that's great.
Just in our virtual auditorium alone, I know of people from the UK and Australia that are regulars.
Great, that's fantastic.
In here, so you're getting some pretty good exposure there.
Good press here, aren't I? Well, I appreciate that.
But yeah, I enjoy doing this. I really do.
And I love what you're doing. I could see myself doing that too. As you know, you mentioned I have some radio background too, so. You know, that was my first love, actually, was radio.
I'm a lousy writer.
Well, I've always been a pretty good writer. My wife, Vicki, is my editor. She does a great job. I want to mention her. She actually edited both books, and she works with me in newspapers. She just does a great job, and she's also a good writer. I told her she's a better writer than I am. But I'm the one that sits down and cranks this out, though. I can just, because of this subject matter, I love it, and I can just sit down sometimes when I get in a flow and just continue to write till my hands are cramping. In fact, this new book's going to have about 32,000 words in it, so it's going to be a lot longer than this last one, and I think it's going to be real good.
Do you mind if I read the dedication?
Please do.
His dedication says, to my loving wife, Vicki, who gave me the confidence and encouragement needed to complete this project. Thank you for your love and support. This is also dedicated to my daughters, Erin and Tina, my son, Matt, and my granddaughters. I hope this makes them proud. And to tell you honest truth, I think they will.
Well, I think so, too. I'm a family person, small town, you know, and family comes first, and, you know, it did help being with Vicki. You know, she gives me a lot of confidence and support and encouragement. And it's good to have somebody like that behind you. And, you know, sometimes I'm my own worst critic, and I'm like you. Oh, I'm not that good of a writer. But to have somebody like her behind me, pushing me, encouraging me, giving me the confidence that I can do it, and then that means a whole lot.
I can relate. If it wasn't for my husband, David, I would be so unorganized.
Yeah, I know. It's good to have somebody, a good mate in it. We're getting all mushy here. Let's get back on the... looking at my next book here. I've got another story here that's near where I live. It's a little town called Matewan, West Virginia. I mentioned the Hatfield McCoy feud. This is, if you get online, this is near where that happened. And this wasn't that long ago, and actually in 2004. And the guy that I know real well saw this huge triangular UFO, and it sounded almost like what they saw in Phoenix there a few years ago, the Phoenix lights. And what was good about this is there was another real credible witness that saw something the same night, and they didn't know that each other had seen it. But as I was looking into this, I found out the other guy. And the other guy that that saw it was a guy that used to work in radio. I worked with him. He was a news person in radio, so a very credible witness. And he saw this huge UFO, and they both shared their story, and I put that into one chapter, and it's just really good. And the first guy that saw it, and his name, well, I'm calling him Craig because he didn't want to give his real name. The other guy's name was Alan Maynard. He didn't care for me to use his name. But he was awakened in the middle of the night by his dogs. They were barking real loud, yelping, really howling, he said. And he said it woke him up, and he saw this light outside. He thought, well, there must be some prowlers or something. So he goes outside. He says, and when I look up, I see this huge craft. He said, I mean, it was so big that it was as big as two football fields. You know, he said it was blocking out the stars because it was a clear night. And then he saw this light beaming down from this craft, and it was beaming down on the roofs of the other houses in the neighborhood. And he, you know, the way he described the craft and everything, it was just real similar. It reminded me of the Phoenix, the people that I heard describe the Phoenix lights, the object they saw a few years ago. But he then, the next thing he remembers, though, he woke up in bed, and he doesn't even remember going back in, and he was soaking wet. And again, you know, it makes you think maybe he was abducted. You know, he doesn't know for sure, but it really sounds like it. But after that, he said he was real scared. He started sleeping with a gun under his bed, and he was just having a real tough time sleeping. And, you know, it was another eerie incident. And I get into more detail, of course, in that with the book and his story. But, again, another one of those stories that would have never probably been told to the folks out there. He heard me on a local radio station, and that's when he contacted me, talking about my first book, and then he wanted to share this story with me. So, and then what was good is that we had another witness that was probably a couple miles away, was actually working that night on the third shift at a coal mine on top of a mountain in a strip mine, and he saw a UFO, and it was the same time. So, you know, it again gives them credibility.
That's interesting.
Yeah, it is. I mean, again, I'm not going as much in detail as I will in the book, but this gives you a little tidbits of what you can look forward to.
What's the most unusual story you have for your new book?
Let's see. That one's a pretty good one. I like that Moorhead, Kentucky story that I told you about earlier with the screams.
Yeah.
And the several witnesses.
It's a chilling food.
This one about... a train. It's a CSX train. We have a couple of railroads in this region that haul coal and freight. But the fact that there's, and again, this was reported to the National UFO Recording Center, that these guys, of course, they work late at night. Trains go all the time transporting. And then they come around a bend, the tracks, I guess there were mountains on one side and a river on the other side, and saw these three bright lights, and as they come around the curve, one of the lights came toward them and struck the train. Well, of course, the train then sort of was crippled, and it eventually ended up going into a railroad yard, And when they had radioed and said, you know, told them what happened, told the, I guess, their dispatcher what happened. And when they got there, reportedly there were this big tent set up and all these people waiting on them. They get them off, they question them, they examine them, they, you know, and supposedly then they take the part of the train that was struck by the UFO and took it, whether this was government officials or what. But again, it was covered up, another cover up. And, you know, it's another interesting story. It makes you wonder. But that happened over in Kentucky. So another good one.
What's the oldest case that you interviewed for?
Probably in the first book there, the 50s, mid-50s. I don't have had any farther back than that. A few in the 60s and 70s. And some new ones, which I like, you know. Again, I have that diverse age group and then that diverse time frame from the 50s up until now. So, you know, again, it shows you that this phenomenon has been going on for such a long time. And, you know, there's got to be something to it.
Oh, I agree.
I'm sure, you know, there's folks out there that... Here's another one I just ran across. I'm looking through my archives here. This one had to have a lot of witnesses. Again, this was in 73, and it was documented in the local newspaper from October of 73, which, again, was when you had the UFO wave where there was hundreds of sightings in the United States, especially on the East Coast. That's when I had one of my sightings. But it was in near Pikeville, Kentucky, which is only about 30 miles from here. And it was a Friday night football game. I mean, you know, we're out in America like they do all across on Friday nights during the fall. Everybody goes out, especially in small towns, and they're watching the local football teams. And everybody at this football game saw a UFO, and it was reported in a newspaper. So some, you know, sometimes you did get some documentation. I've got another story from... Yeah, I forgot about this one. A couple of young boys who were fishing. I call them, you know, Mark Twain and Huckleberry Finn. And this was from 1978, not too far from here. This is a Mingo County story. And they saw a UFO late one evening while they were fishing. And again, through their descriptions, it makes you wonder if they were abducted or not. Now, one of these, of course, they were like, they were 14 and 13 at the time. This was 1978. One of these guys still lives near where this incident happened. Tried my best to contact him. I actually did talk to his wife to get him to talk to me now about the incident, but he won't talk about it now. I did talk to one of his friends, and his friend said ever since that happened that he was a changed person, and he would never talk about it again. So, you know, it obviously had a adverse effect on him. So something had to happen, you know.
Well, we have about 3.5 minutes left. If you'd like to tell us of any speaking engagements you might have coming up.
I'm going to be next Saturday at a place called Tamarack, which is along the interstate between Beckley and Charleston, West Virginia. It's a show place there along the interstate. When people are traveling, they can stop by, and I'm going to do a book signing there, and I'll be there. I know I've probably got another book signing in Huntington, West Virginia later this summer, but I don't have the date right in front of me. And I've been trying to find out if they're going to have another UFO conference in Charleston in September. That's when they've had the last two, and I think they will. If so, I will be there. Up in Point Pleasant area, they have what they call the Mothman Festival in October. I want to try to contact those folks and maybe make an appearance up there and take some books. So that's all I've got scheduled at this time, but hopefully I'll get the word out. Maybe I'll contact you if I get any speaking engagements, and you can let everybody know.
Yeah, Fantastic. And where can they find your book again?
Go to Amazon.com and or WoodlandPress.com, which is my publisher. If you're here in this region, you can find it at a lot of the bookstores in Charleston, Huntington, Lexington, and my little hometown, Williamson, some of these places. But online is probably the best way. Just go to Amazon or .com or WoodlandPress.com. I appreciate it if everybody checks it out. And then be looking for the next one when it comes out later this year.
And the current one is Appalachian Case Study, UFO Sightings, Alien Encounters, and the Unexplained Phenomenon. I keep wanting to put the in there for some silly reason. And, you know, I've read this book. It's really an interesting little book. It's a perfect travel-sized book.
Yeah, it's paperback. Again, this is a small publisher, but... you know, I think it looks good. It's put together well, and it is, like you say, a good size. It's about 100 pages. And my next one's going to be a little longer, so I'm pleased with that.
I'm looking forward to that one. That one sounds really, really good.
Yeah, I'm real excited about it. Like I say, I think I learned a lot after writing this book. I had to try to find the transition from writing newspaper stories to writing a book, because with a newspaper, you're restricted to writing so many words. You have to keep your stories down, and I sort of realize that now. And the publisher said, hey, you could be a little more, you know, extravagant with your wording and explain things in more in-depth if you want to. So I've done that with this next one.
Yeah, instead of having to make it short and sweet,
exactly,
you can go into to detail.
But, you know, in some of the most of, and I've been lucky, I've had some good book reviews, and they liked that in a way. They said, you know, my journalism background showed, and that they liked that it was the way it was written, and to the point, you know. And like you said, an easy read.
Unfortunately, we are all out of time.
Wow, it flew by, didn't it?
Doesn't it, though? It never seems like 2 hours is quite long enough.
It's a great subject, though. We could talk about it all night. And, Dee, I really appreciate you having me on, and I hope all the listeners enjoyed it.
Oh, I appreciate you coming on and sharing your work with us. I think, you know, it's a good job that you've done.
And, you know, be glad to be on in a future show, and we'll stay in touch.
Will do. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have for tonight. I want to thank everyone for tuning in, and also thank all of those who joined us in our Pal Talk Virtual Auditorium. You've been a great bunch of people tonight. Appreciate it. Stay tuned for Voice of the People, hosted by November Hansen. Her guests tonight will be Beck Horn and Glennis Heenan, I believe it's pronounced. Also, I want to remind everybody to keep their eyes open for the Joyner Report, hosted by Angela Joyner, beginning May 15th, Friday night, 10 p.m. to 12 a.m. Central Time. Hope you all make her all welcome. And also please join us again next Saturday on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network for another episode of Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis. Until then, keep an eye to the sky. Good night, everyone.